Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is the Skate Podcast, talking Bruins hockey with WEEI Bruins writers Scott McLaughlin, Bridget Prue, and Brian DeFelice. Lace them up for some Bees talk. It's Odyssey's The Skate Pod on WEEI. Woo!
Welcome into episode 308 of The Skate Podcast. I'm Brian DeFelice, joined by Bridget Prue and Scott McLaughlin. The Bruins defeat the Toronto Maple Leafs in game 4, 3-1. The series mirrors that score. Bruins are also up 3-1. Brad Marchand has completely taken over the series on the Boston side of things. Toronto is an absolute shitstorm on the bench. Their stars are bickering in the media. Their talking heads are killing certain players on Toronto. That said, and this is probably going to be a good segue into Scott's opening shift, but the series is not over. So Scott, maybe if you want to tee it up there.
Sure. This is when we see what the Bruins learned from last year. They were in basically the same exact situation. They last year against Florida split the two home games to open the series, went down to Florida, won games 3 and 4, came back to Boston for game 5 with a chance to close out the Panthers and couldn't do it. And we know how that story ended. And they're not the same exact series, and there's lots of things that are different between last year and this year, but that general idea is there. It's, you know, they have the chance. They come home after winning both games in Toronto and have a chance to close out the Leafs in 5. If they don't, things start to get uncomfortable again. Then you're going back to Toronto for game 6. Leafs have a chance to tie the series. Don't let them. Don't even give them life. Like, I want to see this Bruins team close the Leafs out in 5, come out with the intensity and the desperation that you know the Leafs are going to have, or at least you have to assume the Leafs are going to have, right? Maybe the Leafs really are. Brian, you mentioned all those Toronto media ripping the team. Maybe they really are as soft as all of them say. Like, maybe this Leafs team really is just going to fold up shop and go down without a fight.
Just ready for golf season.
If you're the Bruins, you can't assume that. You got to assume they're going to come out the way the Panthers did last year, which was fighting and clawing and kicking and screaming and until the very end, until they beat you, because the Bruins couldn't quite match that over those last 3 games. So, it's going to be fascinating. Jim Montgomery's talked about this a little bit. On Sunday, we got to talk to him when they landed on their way back from Toronto. He said, "I think what we can learn is the urgency it takes to finish off a series. It's so hard to end a team season, and we know that. I think everyone that was part of it last year is better off for it." Okay, so those are the words. Now let's see the actions.
Yeah, and that kind of leads into my opening shift as well, because part of it is a lesson learned from last year to this year in terms of, you know, what it's going to take to close out a series. But it's also about the mistakes that were made last season in those final games that led to the Bruins getting kicked out of the playoffs last year earlier than expected. So one of the things that was criticized, and you could say Montgomery was guilty of, was over manipulating the lineup. And I know he felt like he had to, because of trying to get Bergeron and Krejci back into the series, trusting those guys, working with new players that came in at the trade deadline. Like, it made more sense to do last year, though it was still easy to see that something about it was causing the team to be just a little bit out of whack. So my opening shift is the Bruins this time, they win game 3 and game 4 in Toronto. It seemed like everything was working, especially in game 4. do they just stick with the same exact thing and run it back and not try to overcompensate, not try to make adjustments that might cause confidence to change, which obviously includes goaltending, because everybody is seeing how well Stoyman is playing right now. So we'll get into that after Brian finishes his opening shift. Do you run back the game four lineup, or is there something minor or major that you want to see change in order to try to close out the series in game five?
So I like both of your opening takes, because you keep it between the boards, and certainly there's a lot of X's and O's and all that to discuss going forward in this podcast. But I have to get something off of my chest quickly regarding my opening shift, because
like me before the podcast.
Yes, I will keep that in the locker room, Bridget.
Yeah, that doesn't need to be out of the locker room.
But
now you just teased everyone. I feel like
no. It doesn't need to come on the podcast.
All right, yeah, you're the one who brought it up.
Hey, you know, sometimes we need to vent about our personal lives, but our listeners don't necessarily get to hear about that part.
Okay, well, that's up to you if you want to disclose that at some point. But for now, I'll keep it to the opening shift, which is so again, part of what makes watching sports great is the storylines, the chatter, the headlines, the articles outside of the 60 minutes. It's the reason why the NFL is so popular, because you get one game a week on Sunday, and it's like a soap opera. Every week you get one episode. When you play the Toronto Maple Leafs in the postseason, there is that in such a vast variety that from the Boston perspective, I can't help but tune in to what they're saying north of the border. And we all know hockey is gospel in Canada, and Toronto is the Roman Empire. It's the Mecca of hockey, right? And you would think that their fans and their analysts would be very educated. And it just seems like they're so focused on the blue and white up there that they just don't even analyze or give respect or credit to the opposition, in this case, Boston. And while they're spending so much time and energy talking about how Marner and Matthews and Nylander and Tavares aren't playing and Morgan Riley aren't playing up to snuff, at the same time, they're not giving the Bruins credit or recognizing how good of a team they are. And despite the fact that Toronto's blue line and goaltending is hot garbage, both on paper and on the ice, these people in Toronto think that the Maple Leafs are such a superior, more talented team than Boston. And it blows my mind. It's like, not only have the Bruins historically always had the upper advantage on Toronto in postseason play, as we know, the Bruins, we all know, broke records last year. Yes, there was significant roster turnover, but this year we're also leading the Atlantic Division all season, which Toronto is in until the very end, which probably now was to play Toronto. They are ahead of Toronto in the standings all season and have also won 10 of their last meetings against Toronto. So when you hear these people talk about the series, all you hear them talk about is how the Maple Leafs top stars aren't playing and that the Bruins are like lucky to be getting these wins. And it's like, I know this is not a very important thing, but when it's a playoff series, it is fun to follow the other side. And it blows my mind that people just don't acknowledge how good McAvoy and Lindholm are in the blue line and Carlo. And they think it's just Pasternak and McAvoy. And it's just, like, anyway, I just wanted to get that off of my chest. I don't know if you guys have picked up on this being in the media as well.
Yeah, it's kind of like a shooting your foot mentality where it's like, okay, no, like some of this has to do with Boston just having a good game plan against them. It's like they think that Boston is like the iceberg and they're the Titanic and they're like the guy manning the ship and it's his stupid fault that he hit the iceberg. So that's what they think of it like.
Yeah, and I would actually expand this to say this happens in some Boston media too. Like there's, you know, you'll definitely hear it on talk radio, but I think even in some written coverage, you know, this idea that, well, the Leafs are chokers and they're always chokers, and so the Bruins aren't really going to get the credit that they deserve if and when they win this series. And it's like, no, they absolutely deserve credit. Like, listen, the Leafs got that first round monkey off their back. Like, they won a round last year. They beat that Tampa Bay team that like everyone still fears and says, hey, they still have all that championship DNA, which is true. Like the Leafs beat that team in six games last year. And it's like that because that wasn't a series against the Bruins, it just gets completely ignored. And yeah, it is kind of like when it happens from the Boston side, it's even kind of more baffling. It's clearly people with an agenda trying to, who don't want to give the Bruins credit. And it's like, the Bruins are going to be responsible for the Leafs if they finish this off. And we're going to get into what they have to do that and how they, you know, tying into my opening shift, like how they avoid what happened last year. But if the Bruins finish this off, they're going to be the group that killed Toronto's core four, because they are not going to keep that together if they bow out in the first round this year. And that is like a pretty remarkable accomplishment, you know, to kill something that once was so promising for Toronto. And obviously, you know, long before now, it hasn't really panned out, but like those are some of the best players in the league. And you have a chance to be the team that splits it up at a time when, you know, you're supposed to be in a transition season. Like you're the one who your core got broken up after last season with Bergeron and Krejci retiring. And this was supposed to be just transitioning, you know, saving up for this summer when you have cap space and you can reload. Meanwhile, this is supposed to be like the Leafs' chance to really go for when they have all these guys. And instead, you've, depending on how you want to look at it, like stayed ahead of them or jumped back ahead of them during a transition year. And like now you're on the verge of putting an end to their prime year and forcing them to, you know, conduct a pretty dramatic overhaul this offseason, it seems like.
Yeah, and you mentioned there was some reporting on this. Was it this morning or yesterday? Where basically if they don't make it out of the first round, and I kind of feel like they have to make it even farther than the second round, probably to make the case that this should be a salvageable team that can make a cup run, right? Like it feels like the ceiling or the floor. The floor of what they have to do to keep the team together is really, really high. Like you have to make it a few rounds. You have to show that this team has a chance and, you know, they're worth trying to run it back with. Otherwise, the shakeup seems like it's going to happen. And it feels like it would almost be a certainty that Sheldon Keefe would be on his way out if they get bounced by the Bruins in this round. And potentially, like, if things go wrong the next round or what have you, it just seems like the media there at least make it seem like he's so unpopular and not doing a good job at all. So like, obviously we're kind of getting that spin because we are not as in touch with the day-to-day goings on of the Leafs just because we're very tuned into Boston and, you know, but they make it sound like it's doomsday if the Bruins knock this Leafs team out in the first round.
Which again, and that's what blows my mind. It's like you can cover Toronto and watch that team, and you can criticize them to the moon for how they've performed, but you also have to look at the rest of the roster beyond Matthews, Marner, Nylander, Tavares, Morgan Rielly, the core four plus Morgan Rielly, whatever you want to call it. Like they're and obviously Auston Matthews is phenomenal. If you watch Nylander and Mitch Marner's details, defensive awareness and stick position and the way and how soft they play on the puck, they can skate like the wind, and I'm sure they would win a couple of pond hockey tournaments around the world. But when you're in the National Hockey League and you're in the Stanley Cup playoffs, that's those little things also make up who you are as a hockey player. It's not just the flash, and that's what you're seeing. So when your best players don't want to play the little details and play the hard way, then your best players aren't really that good in the playoffs, are they? So not only is that a problem, but you're also paying them so much money. that the rest of their roster. And again, I heard people on Toronto radio criticizing, oh, the Bruins aren't special. They're not that good. And they name dropped the Bruins third D pair. And like the third D pair is trash. I'm like, the third D pair is trash. I'm like, Kevin Shattenkirk is a veteran in the league who is a Stanley Cup champion. Mason Lorre is a who actually has been playing with McAvoy, but like, so
Parker Watherspoon.
Watherspoon's,
yeah, they probably like, hadn't heard of him, but that doesn't mean that he,
which is
hasn't
fair, but it's like,
season.
Are you, which is fair, but are you watching the game and like, and, no. But it's like, look at Toronto's defense. Like Morgan Riley is not that great defensively. And beyond him, it's Ilya Labushkin and Joel Edmondson and TJ Brody who gets walked. And who else do they have? Jake McCabe, who like literally has no hockey IQ whatsoever. He's just looking for Marchand to hit all series. So it's just, anyway, I'm just surprised at the lack of respect that Boston's getting. Charlie Coyle, Pavel Zacha, they get no recognition by anybody. And it's just, wow, it's very surprising.
I think it has more to say about the mentality, the like, the sky is falling mentality. Like, it almost like feels like they want to see it, like some sort of satisfaction out of blaming like it completely on players that they, because they're investing their emotions into these players. So when they see something they don't like, it's like, okay, that makes sense. Like we're going to come at them. We're going to say it's their fault. And it was really coming down hard on Nylander earlier in the series. And then I saw some comments on Austin Matthews not coming back for the third period. Like, okay, he waved the white flag. He's ready to go golfing. Like, you know, saying he, you know, both him and Nylander should be playing through, or should have been playing through what was going on with them, which obviously medically, we don't know 100%, but seems kind of crazy to say without knowing that someone should just be out there playing through. And you could tell Matthews wasn't himself. So it's,
yeah. It's just great content. Like, especially if you're Toronto based, it's, you know,
it's a sideshow.
What's more interesting? Like, the end of this era of Maple Leafs hockey, or I guess the Bruins are still good. Like it's the downfall of the Leafs. So, like, that's why they lean in.
But they also, but I believe, so there's what you say over the airwaves and in the headlines for, you know, for those clicks, for that narrative. But you listen to them and like they truly believe that the Bruins are just just along for the ride. It's like, they've literally
believe that the refs are to blame.
Yes,
too.
And that's like, something, it's like totally every, different.
Refs and poor play by Toronto, and it's like rigged against them, yet it's also right. Their fault.
And they Toronto has more power plays. The Bruins definitely have never get missed calls against them. But again, you listen to them, and it's like, am I missing something? The Bruins have won 10 of the last 11 games against Toronto, and I know that that's not really relevant, especially for game five. But my point is, clearly the Bruins are a good team and better than their highly touted, you know, Maple Leafs. So anyway,
yeah.
Scott, well, you and I on Tuesday should, when we're eating in the dining hall, just plop ourselves down at the Leafs media table and just have a conversation. I got to figure out what's going on over there.
So, but it's also, there's like two different factions of Leafs media, because there's a bunch of Leafs media that I actually think is great and like,
yeah,
does a legitimately great job covering the team. You know, it's like Luke Fox, Jonas Siegel, David Alter, probably other people I'm forgetting. Like, they actually do a really good job, and I think are very fair. But then there's all the columnists and like their sports radio up there, which probably has a louder voice in the grand scheme of things, and so that's what a lot of people hear. You know, the talent thing, like we talked about this a little bit on Sunday Skate with Razor. You know, there is this idea that the Leafs are more talented, but it's like, I feel like that's just focusing on one position. Like, clearly they are more talented at forward, no doubt. You know, if you line up 1 through 4 and give them Matthews, Nylander, Marner, Tavares versus who are the Bruins' four most talented forwards? Pastrnak, Marchand, Coyle, Zacha, probably. Like, it's no competition. Clearly the Leafs are more talented. But that's one position. Like, who's more talented in goal? That seems pretty damn lopsided, doesn't it? Who's more talented on defense? I'll take McAvoy over Riley any day. I'll take Lindholm over anyone else on Toronto's blue line. I might take Carlo over anyone else on Toronto's blue line. So Bruins are more talented there. And it's like, it's a clash of styles. It's a clash of how rosters are built. And through four games, the Bruins are winning pretty decisively with the way they're built.
And unfortunately for Toronto, again, outside of those four players, they're really not more talented than the Bruins. The Bruins are more talented, A, but B, if it was a matchup, those four top four forwards versus Boston's top four forwards, Boston's top four forwards all have a higher work ethic. I mean, I think Austin Matthews has been throwing his weight around and he's trying as best as he can, I think. But like Marner and Nylander, their battle effort is so low. Charlie Coyle and Pavel Zacha might not have their talent overall, but their work ethic, at least in this series, is clearly making up for that. And I don't know if you guys saw the hit by Jesper Boqvist on William Nylander in game four behind the net. There was a bit of a scrum behind on the end wall behind the net. And Boqvist just kind of went over and like literally barely tapped Nylander. And on the TNT feed, you see Nylander who stops and looks at Boqvist and smiles at him and smirks at him as if like, buddy, what are you doing? Probably because they're both Swedish and, you know, they might know each other. But because Nylander thinks he's so much better than Boqvist and Boqvist shouldn't be on the same ice as him, he just like looks at Boqvist and the puck goes the other way and Nylander doesn't backcheck and he changes on a backcheck. It's like, it's just absolute mind-boggling to me, the lack of hockey IQ or awareness or effort with these guys. And we haven't even talked about Marner yet really in detail, but it's just crazy.
You want to hear something else that I've been seeing in terms of like Leaf side of coverage? Jeremy Swayman is like a top of mind for them. And just that the Leafs had the pick before Swayman and took a different goalie. and that has caused them some serious angst at this point. They chose Ian Scott with the 110th pick.
Great last name.
Ian Scott. And I'm not sure where he is in life at this point, but Jeremy Swayman pick 111 to the Bruins right after. And that does feel like it should sting a little bit.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Yeah, and I mean, on that, like, part of that's just goalie development. Like, Swayman has had great development since then. Mm-hmm. Up at Maine, working with Alfie Michaud, and then through the Bruins system, which has, you know, with Bob Asenza and Mike Dunham, like, clearly does a good job developing goalies, and the Leafs cannot figure that out.
I believe that this guy is no longer playing hockey. Ian Scott. I never played a game in the NHL.
Yeah, I've never heard of him. He sounds like he was
time bummer.
He sounds like he'd be in like a 70s English heavy metal band. like one of those
two
bands,
first names.
One of those bands had a lead singer named Ian Scott, I think.
Well, maybe it was him, because I'm pretty sure he played his last hockey game in 2021. So,
also, just on like the forward comparison, obviously in this series, like talent's one thing. In this series, it hasn't been close. Marchand alone has 8 points. That is more than Matthews, Marner, Nylander, and Tavares combined.
Yeah. He, like I said off the top, he has taken over this series, and we mentioned it before game three that they needed him to turn it on, and he has turned it on more than anybody could have even hoped for. That he really is, the switch has flipped, and it's not so much that he's trying any harder or he's doing anything. It's just working for him now. He's got the confidence going, and he's absolutely vintage Marchand right now. Quickly on Swayman, because you guys brought him up, we should mention, and I'm sure, I know you guys talked about it on Sunday Skate, but he got back-to-back starts. And I also think that post-game that Jim Montgomery may have tipped his hand as to what the quote-unquote plan was that they talked about, which was they told both goalies, you're each going to get a start in the first two games, and then we're just going to go game to game, maybe on who gives us a better chance to win, which sounds kind of familiar, Bridget, does it not, that plan?
Yes, it does. It's not Scott's version. And Razor was quick to point out that even though he likes Scott and respects his opinion, that Scott couldn't weasel his way out of the fact that he chose, it was a 4-game rotation. Scott's like, no, I only meant 2 games. I was like, no, I'm pretty sure you meant 4, Scott. So
okay, I don't want to talk about this. So I might have like known this somewhere deep in my mind, but Scott Ian was the rhythm guitarist and lyricist of the thrash metal band Anthrax.
You have it reversed, but sure, it's close enough. Because the goalie's name is Ian.
I think that knowledge must have been somewhere rattling around in my brain.
Apparently so. Deep reference. I thought he was about to defend himself about his take, and he comes out with that.
Anyways, let's move on from the rotation. What else do we want to talk about?
That's what I thought.
And we honestly can. I just wanted to mention that because it was the game 4 of round 1, and Jim Montgomery did deviate from the 50-50 split. So it's worth mentioning, and I think I don't see why we can't assume going forward that it's probably going to be a game-to-game decision, because I could see a world where they want to go with Ullmark on Tuesday, just to get him back into the game, and there's a 3-1 series cushion. And Bridget, I see you shaking your head. I wouldn't do that, but I could see why they would. I genuinely think it's going to be a game-to-game thing now. And it'll be Swayman in game 5 because you have 2 days of rest, similar to the game 3-4 break.
Yeah, I just don't think it's going to happen for game 5. But I think maybe next series, if the Bruins get past Toronto, Ullmark gets right back in there in one of the first two games of that series, reset, re-rack, because it's a different opponent. And Ullmark's been good against presumably Florida if everything pans out the way that it looks like right now. But so we don't have to talk too much about the goalie rotation, guys, but the Swayman talk about, is he going to be back in net for game 5 we can connect it back to my opening shift, which is, were there any changes that you think were necessary, or was that such a strong performance, a frustrating performance, where you got in the Leafs' head and you did the little things right? Was the personnel that played in game 4 what you would roll back for game 5?
You definitely don't need to change anything. And for the record, I would not change the goalie. Keep riding Swayman until the Leafs beat him at this point. Go for the kill shot.
Richard clipped that one off for the Twitter feed.
Done.
The only, up front, listen, I think James Van Riemsdyk has played well. He stays in. Razor mentioned he thought Johnny Beecher had a little bit of a rough game in game 4, and I think that's probably fair. I'm not in any rush to take him out of the lineup. I still think that line's been good overall in this series. If you wanted to sub Lauko in, I guess you could. That's kind of fringy. I don't think that really makes or breaks your game anyways.
That would be only if you're thinking, because Lauko doesn't take faceoffs. Beecher does. I know he didn't do well at the dot game 4. But normally he's pretty good, right? That could have just been a one-off game. He also helps kill penalties. He's got these different usages that Lauko doesn't. I think Lauko's a stronger forechecker, but it doesn't feel like that's been an issue in the series for the Bruins. So it feels like you still have the upside of Beecher there. And it's not like Beecher can't forecheck, right? So that's my thoughts on it.
I probably wouldn't. The only other place would be, do you take out Kevin Shattenkirk on defense? Because his minutes have been way down. 10 minutes game 3, 11 game 4. He's a -3 at 5-on-5 in the series. And while I don't really think any of the goals against were his fault. You know, Razor put it best on Sunday Skate. He was like, he just always seems to be like just off on a couple of those goals. Like he's right in the area, but just doesn't quite have enough to make the play. Like the Marner goal in game four, it's like he's right there, and it's a great play by Marner to kind of go through his legs and, you know, dangle while he's down on a knee. But, you know, Shattenkirk is there. He just isn't able to really do anything about it. I could see that because, you know, we talked about, like, Shattenkirk's in, obviously, mostly for power play duties. You could put Lauri on the power play. Like, Lauri's done that every level he's been at. I thought he looked pretty good when the Bruins did have him on the power play earlier this season. So that's an option, too. And you could put, you know, either it's Grizzlick going back in or maybe Derek Forbort if he's ready. Derek Forbort was on the ice for pregame warmups on Saturday. I asked Jim Montgomery on Sunday if Forbort's game ready. And, you know, of course it's the playoffs, so he's not actually going to give a clear answer, but he said they're just trying to get him back in his game day routine. And he wouldn't say if he'll be an option for game five. He said, you know, we'll find out Tuesday. So that's it. That's that.
I think I would just roll back the game four lineup, try to give the same group a chance to close out the series. And until somebody gives you a real reason to take them out, then the group that's been out there has had success against the current opponent. I think give the same group a chance. I think Mason Lauri has looked great. I think game three, obviously we mentioned it a little bit, but a couple of rookie moments for him, but even still, I thought he was a net positive in game three. Game four, looking more and more comfortable, and steps up on the left point there to force Ryan Reeves's hand, and I think it goes off of Lauri's skate and then back to JVR for the opening goal. So again, that's the offensive instincts. That's the knowing when to pinch that Grizzlick brings, but down the other end of the ice, and other aspects of Lauri's game, the passing has been there, the composure has been there. Almost had an absolute highlight reel goal between the legs, top left, but he couldn't get the shot off. But my point is, he brings a lot of what
I'm giving him the Conn Smythe on the spot if he pulled that off.
I think he brings a lot of the positives that Matt Grizzlick brings. I also think he can maybe do it a little bit better. And down the other end of the ice, I've liked his compete, and he's not noticeably losing a ton of battles. So I would keep Lauri in, and I'm not going to die on the keep Kevin Shattenkirk hill. But again, like I said a minute ago, just give the same group a chance to close out the series, and maybe next series you kind of get forward in game one.
Yeah, I think, to be honest with you, if they're not 100% sure that it, and this could just be part of the gamesmanship or just part of the not wanting to fully disclose things, but if Forbort is still working on just getting back in the game day routine, I feel like there's still a little bit of time left to get him up to speed enough. And this is a closeout game. And this is a game where you might need Shattenkirk on your power play. That could be a decisive moment because the Leafs penalty kill has not been good. And we know that Shattenkirk can facilitate at the point. And who knows, he might have an impact, an assist or something on a power play goal. So he has that upside. He hasn't been getting as many minutes. And him and Weatherspoon, not an ideal pair. Weatherspoon Peak was a stronger pair, but Peak's not available. Obviously, he's still out week to week. So I'm thinking, without going into like every single roster position and why they should stay in, I would keep it the same way.
Yeah, I think, you know, I realized, like, as Brian was talking, I realized as I ran through the lineup, like, I didn't even mention Lauri or Weatherspoon. That's because taking them out, not even a consideration for me. Like, they've both clearly done enough to stay in. Weatherspoon especially has just been rock solid. And Lauri, we talked about in the last podcast, I said, you know, there was enough good there in game three. There were a couple glaring mistakes. And I said, hey, listen, if the glaring mistakes are still there, maybe he's coming out for game five. Well,
he worked through it.
Yeah, he was clean game four. Like,
yeah,
really nothing stood out in the negative. And yeah, he definitely made positive contributions.
And I think that the only shift I noticed a little bit of a sense of nerves was the very first shift, which is obviously explainable and understandable. But as the game went on, both him and Weatherspoon seemed to just pick it up each period, just getting better and making good plays. And Weatherspoon broke up a lot of passes to the crease, a lot of passes that were intended to go across the slot. He was breaking things up in front of the net really well. So I wouldn't take him out either. I think that that's not an option. And I think, remember we were saying, is it too risky to put Lauri in because of the inexperience? But now I'm at the point where, and I didn't believe that, by the way, but now I'm at the point where I think it's too risky to put Grzelcyk back in because of some of the things that happened in the first two games where he was getting overpowered, in particular by the fourth line, by bigger guys, losing pucks and having trouble transitioning. I feel like it's more of a risk to put a player like that in, where you could see a situation where he tries to break the puck out, gets it knocked off a stick, and then it's in the back of the net right away. So I feel like that's the riskier move at this point, based on what we've seen in a two-game sample size for both guys.
And forward-looking, if the Bruins were to be successful in finishing off Toronto in five games, or, you know, six or seven, you would likely be playing Florida in the second round, and that's not a matchup that really is conducive to Matt Grzelcyk being in the lineup because of their heavy forecheck. And if you, I know Toronto's gotten bigger and stronger with Reeves and a couple of others, but if you can't hold up against a Toronto forecheck, which has been pretty non-existent for the most part in this series, Florida's an even taller task, obviously. And I even think if you're the Bruins, if you go into that Florida series, if Forbert's healthy and Peak is healthy, I don't even know if Kevin Shattenkirk's somebody that the Bruins want in a lineup against Florida. Now, he's been part of a power play that's been at like a scoring at like a 40-ish percent pace in this first round series because they've kind of gone to these two unit looks, and he's a part of that. The Bruins would have to ask themselves, do we want to maybe put Lauri in that spot, like Scott mentioned earlier, and have a third D pair that really can hold up on a now this is forward looking, so it's not even to do with this Maple Leaf series, but my point is, if the Bruins get healthy on the back end, it's not just Grzelcyk that's going to be struggling for ice time. I think even Shattenkirk, who's currently in the lineup, could have a problem. Obviously Peaks week to week, like you said, so that could, who knows when that is. But, and then Justin Brazeau is another guy, and this kind of goes to Scott's opening shift, like finishing it off in five games is great because the series with Toronto is a series that everybody kind of expected to go six or seven. I know us on this panel all said six or seven, Bruins and six or seven, but the Panthers are up 3-1 on Tampa Bay, so there's a good chance that series is over in five or six. And rests and attrition, the battle of attrition is important. If you can finish off Toronto in five and give Peak some time to get healthy before round two, and maybe Brazeau, and it would just benefit the Bruins. And you don't want to flirt with any doubt, right? That happened last year. That Linus Ullmark, Matt Grzelcyk blunder, that was in game five. The Bruins had two more chances to win after that, the series, and they had leads in game six and seven. But the second that the Bruins lost that game five in overtime, you were just like, oh my God, you were a shot away from Marchand winning. You were a shot away in overtime from ending the series. Now you're going to go back to Florida, and there's that doubt and there's that believability for the opponent. So the Bruins need to do all that they can to eliminate that and just get the job done on Tuesday night.
Yeah. Especially because, you know, as we talked about, like everything around the Maple Leafs is like, sky's falling, you know, goaltending stinks. Their stars aren't scoring. Matthews is sick. And, you know, Nylander was obviously dealing with something. Keefe's going to get fired. The whole team, you know, Core is going to get blown up, like all that. Well, all of a sudden, you know, you give them a game, all of a sudden they go back home with a little bit of hope in game six. Like, yeah, stating the obvious, but like ideally, do not give them any life. Like, don't just bury them. And Brian, you're right. Like, the the timing, the schedule, the rest, like that's all important too. I thought the Panthers, you know, not completing the sweep of the Lightning, you like seeing that, like at least they have to play another game. But yeah, like that, you know, you don't want to go seven if Florida wraps it up in five and gets to just wait around and get everyone healthy and ready, you know, ready to go out there and run around and hit everyone.
Not only that, but the more games you play in the playoffs, the more worn down the healthy guys get, the more exhausted they get, and the more chances that they have of getting injured, like more injuries accruing, because you got guys blocking shots in two more games than they would have had to play. And yeah, it's a whole, I hate to say this again, butterfly effect. We talked a little bit about this last episode, but like you never know what's going to happen if you extend series and what other injuries or whatnot could occur.
Yeah. We're recording this Sunday night, and just watching the games like throughout Sunday afternoon, I saw like four different guys get hit in the face with pucks and like leave. Some came back, like a couple didn't. Like it's, again, just anything can happen. And that's just guys getting hit in the face with pucks. Like, never mind all the other injuries we see in every game. And it's like, it seems to be happening in every series now, where you're already seeing like that war of attrition of key guys leaving, at least banged up, some not returning. The Canucks are down to their third goalie. And literally while we're recording, they just came back with two late goals and beat Nashville in overtime to go
Nashville.
Up 3-1.
Nashville hit the post on an empty net too. The goalie pulled, hit a post, and then Besser tied it with 6 seconds left. So another thing that I've, so we will find out on Tuesday night if the Bruins can have learned from last year, right? They know what they let slip away last year, but they have to go out and execute Tuesday to really prove that, you know, they've learned enough to get over that hurdle of letting a team stay around. But there has been something that I've learned about this Bruins team through four games so far, which is they are really buying in top to bottom. They shift to shift. Obviously game two is not great, but you watch the shot blocking going on by Boston right now. You watch the back check efforts, the puck battle efforts from players, by the way, who I've criticized at times this year for not doing these things. Jake DeBrusk is one of them. He's been absolutely amazing away from the puck, with the puck all series. But the commitment to blocking shots, the commitment to clogging the middle of the ice, getting back, outnumbering your opponent on loose pucks and whatnot. It's not, you look at the Bruins roster last year and it was littered with veterans that have, you know, they knew how to win. So it's not like the Bruins didn't appreciate those things last year. It's just that right now they look like a really stingy playoff team that's going to be tough to score against. They kind of remind me of a little bit, with a little bit more offensive flair, but they kind of remind me of the New York Islanders of like 3-4 years ago, where they just kind of blocked a lot of shots, commitment to defense, which is kind of what we said the Bruins would have to do all year with a little bit of a lack of offense up front on paper. And so if the Bruins are able to defeat Toronto in this playoff series, like I just feel like this team is they're built for this playoff run right now. I don't know how far they're going to go, but don't fall victim to the reverse of last year. Like last year, everybody looked at the Bruins roster on paper and said, how could they possibly lose to anybody, let alone Florida? Don't look at Toronto. Don't look at potentially Florida and look at their rosters at times and be like, oh, the Bruins just can't stack up, because it's not true. A and B, the Bruins are playing a really quality style and brand of hockey right now. And they also have the Bruins have more size than they did last year. And I know size isn't everything, but you have Lauri back there. You have Pat Maroon on the fourth line. Justin Brazeau could be healthy when he comes back. Watherspoon, peak if he's healthy. Frederick's a big boy. JVR has. So this Bruins team they're stingy. I'm impressed by the way they've all bought in and they've followed Brad Marchand as a leader so far in the first four games.
That was very well said. And I'll add that I feel like there's more certainty with the roster this year, because your top two centers aren't questionable. each day, like the drama that was surrounding that and whether or not they were fully healthy. And those are two huge positions. And you feel like even though the roster on paper probably isn't as good as last year, the certainty is helping. Like, we're talking about making zero changes from game four to game five. And you're talking about being comfortable with the health of the guys that are in there, comfortable with how they play with each other. The chemistry is good enough. There's not a whole lot of question marks about that, which is something that wasn't a part of that series last year with Florida, if you'll remember. And also, yeah, the whole President's Trophy curse, which I would just say is just a mindset that the pressure is on you. That pressure isn't there either. And that's a mental thing as well. So I'm just listing some of the differences between this year and last year.
Yeah. Now, the flip side of that, and, you know, knock on wood, it hasn't happened yet, but if the Bruins have some sort of injury to, say, a top six forward, they are much less equipped to deal with it than they were last year. Like, last year, they won playoff games with Bergeron and Krejci out of the lineup. It's hard to imagine them doing that this year, but they haven't had to do it yet, so, you know, cross that bridge when we get there. But
I dislike that you even brought that up.
I mean, listen, like, injuries happen. You're facing a Toronto team like right now that had William Nylander for three games, you know,
and like
Austin Matthews out for a third period, like,
and only playing at like 30% of his normal self in the minutes that he did play in game four.
Yeah, and so, just on like the playing the right way, huge part of it is they're getting the best goaltending in the playoffs right now. Jeremy Swayman has been the best goalie in the Stanley Cup playoffs. Kind of not even close. You know, Shesterkin really good, but that's kind of about it. Like, maybe Freddie Anderson, but it's Swayman pretty clearly head and shoulders above. And then the Bruins defensively have gotten better as the series has gone on. I mentioned this stat on Sunday's Skate, but first two games of the series, 5-on-5, Bruins gave up 15 high danger chances in game one, 10 in game two. The last two games combined, they've given up 11. So, like, it's, yes, the goaltending's been awesome, but they've also gotten better defensively, especially 5-on-5, and their penalty kill's been awesome all series. The Leafs are now 1-for-14 on their power plays.
Yeah, and you mentioned this on Sunday Skate. Swayman has made, was it two saves above expected? Basically, two goalies.
He's like five above expected.
Oh, five. Okay, so it was the other way around. Samsonov gave up two more than was expected in the shot selection. And obviously, we talked about one of those was the Frederick goal that didn't have a whole lot of a high percentage of going in, but it did. It squeaked in. And so we could be talking about lineup changes on the Toronto side in net, because Wohl came in for the third. And it seems like it was more than just a, we got to rally the troops, we're down by three, like, kick in the butt kind of move, which sometimes a goalie who's playing well gets taken out because it's like trying to send a message. Felt like it was more than that, because it felt like Samsonov had not performed to the point where, you know, you would say, oh, it wasn't on him why he's getting pulled, and it feels like we might see Wohl in game five.
I think that's probably a strong likelihood. I think another key to the Bruins closing out the series is in five as well, or just in general, is it's hard enough to win in the Stanley Cup playoffs by beating your opponent. It's even harder when you know, you're trying to beat yourself too. Like last year, again, right up until it was 3-1, the Bruins were playing pretty good too. So all that ailed the Bruins was from this point of the series onward. So it just goes to show that if you don't take care of business, there could be a lot left in the series. But you look back at game five, and obviously we know how overtime ended. And, you know, game six, Connor Clifton had tons of, you know, turnovers. Like, Bertuzzi had turnovers. It's just the Bruins allowed the Panthers to come back into that series by self-inflicted wounds. In part, what you're seeing, you are seeing Toronto have self-inflicted wounds in this series as well. I know earlier in the podcast, I mentioned how the Bruins aren't getting a ton of credit from media up north, but the Maple Leafs are, their play is a factor too, but that's why it's been encouraging so far. The Bruins have not, They've not had any careless really mistakes. They're playing sound, and that just needs to continue. That's where things went awry last year against Florida, was the Bruins started to beat themselves, in addition to Florida also ramping up their game too. Sam Bennett coming back was a big turning point too. So if the Bruins can keep limiting those self-inflicted wounds, I think they'll also have better success at moving on to the second round.
Yeah, and Toronto is the team dealing with the bigger circus, right? Swayman, by Swayman playing as well as he has, he's kind of shut down the goalie rotation circus in a way, and there's not a whole lot else at this point to be questioning, right? We're talking about rolling the exact same lineup out. So the distractions are more limited on the Boston side, which you have to imagine mentally helps. Not, and a lot of guys will tell you they don't read into it. They don't listen to media, read whatever, which is probably true. A lot of them probably don't, but they deal with the media after the game. And we're not in the locker room asking the same kind of questions that the Toronto players are getting asked. Mitch Marner got asked about how they were fighting on the, like, it seemed like there was some infighting on the bench. And there's like these more tense questions that are being dealt with after the game by the players, and the tone with how Sheldon Keefe has answered questions. It's completely different than what the Bruins are dealing with, which feels like there's some, at least some mental advantage to not having to deal with the same kind of circus and narratives.
I mean, they really have chosen the worst market to have these theatrics in, because if this was, I mean, you literally had William Nylander on the bench. You can read his lips clear as day, presumably talking to Mitch Marner, saying, "Stop fucking crying, bro. This isn't junior hockey." So if that
was that right after Marner spiked his gloves?
Yeah. It's like a montage of moments. I don't know exactly when they took place,
because that was the Canadian broadcast, so we didn't get to see it here.
But if that happened on a bench, and instead of the Toronto Maple Leafs, they were, oh, I don't know, the Utah Coyotes, like, you're probably not getting, you know, not only does this stuff happen, it happens in Toronto. So, I mean, if this happened in Boston, if you had a camera of, you know, McAvoy saying to Pasternak, "Stop fucking crying, bro. This isn't junior hockey." Like, what will we be doing, right? And we aren't even nearly the, I mean, you have TMZ, MTV equivalents up in Canada following these players around. I heard somebody say on Toronto airwaves that they got text messages from friends that before game four, William Nylander was in some district of Toronto eating ice cream, and that there was video footage on one of the news outlets. Like, imagine if here in Boston, if there was video footage on, like, you know, on a news of David Pasternak at the Burlington Mall eating ice cream, and people being like, "Does he have a migraine? Why is he getting ice cream?" Well, like, it's
he's
crazy.
He's gonna have a brain freeze.
It's like the Phil Kessel hot dog stand all over again. Like,
it's insane. A circus is the exact word, Bridget. It's an absolute circus up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like the Bruins haven't given anyone any drama. Like,
that's what, you know, I'm saying.
The goalie rotation had a good run. It was, you know, great talk show debate and written about plenty. But then it's like, oh, you mean they just get to? But like then it sets in, like, because neither one of them really falters. It's like, oh, you mean they can pick one of the five, like between top two five of the five best goalies in the NHL? And meanwhile, Toronto has like the 28th best goalie. It's like, oh, all right, well, and Swayman just keeps dominating them. Like, all right, well, this isn't that interesting. Like, let's focus on the guy throwing his gloves and the team that's taken six offensive zone penalties. And, you know, William Nylander, when the Leafs have the Bruins kind of on the ropes, or at least under pressure, trying to come back in that game, Jake DeBrus doesn't have a stick, and William Nylander just tackles him around the neck. And it's like, yeah, that's a hell of a lot more interesting and dramatic than like, well, Jeremy Swayman just keeps sopping everything they throw at him.
I do love it. They are professionals up there, though, because it's like, so Max Domi takes an offensive zone penalty, cross-checking David Pasternak. Oh, actually, I guess to be fair, this was the TNT broadcast, but I'm sure they did it on Sportsnet too. So Max Domi cross-checks Pasternak, and it's, as a fan, you're like, what's the one question you're asking yourself? Like, who's the one person you want to see their reaction right now? And of course, the cameras pan over to Ty Domi in the stands, and he is seething. he looks like a dad watching his kid in high school on the boards, just like you're absolute moron. And it, I don't know, it's just like there's just so much fun with what's going on up there. It's
Ty Domi was like, if you're gonna do that, do it a hell of a lot harder than that.
Right, he's probably showing clips of his elbow to Scott Niedermeyer. He's like, this is what you should do if you're gonna take an offensive zone penalty. But anyway,
you're gonna take a penalty against David Possum, not card him.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
that's a classic rule. But yeah, I mean, we've talked about how they've had the self-inflicted and then the Bruins inflicted. And by the way, like, Bruins aren't getting asked in the post game, and Montgomery's not getting asked post game, how can you guys, solve Samsonov? And how can you guys defend X, like, forward, like Matthews? Because Matthews hasn't taken over the series, and we've talked about health-wise, it's probably pretty difficult for him to do that right now. But Toronto's being asked, what's it about Brad Marchand that really gets under your skin? And what's it about Jeremy Swayman that he just has the answer to all of your shots? And it's all right, like an echo chamber.
Which, by the way, Marchand is being hated up there just for existing. Outside of the tanglement with Tyler Bertuzzi, like, he's kept it between the lines. Like, he's not, it's Toronto going out of their way to, like, get him. It's like, people are like, oh, Martian's getting away with everything. He hasn't done anything besides a couple, you know, the trip on Bertuzzi, and they were both tangled up in that game. He was like, people are trying to say he was skating by Toronto's bench saying it's over in five, which it might be. but it's like, you watch the games, it's like, he's not even doing anything.
He did get away with an elbow on Bertuzzi.
Like, oh, that's right. Okay.
That was, like, legit got away with it. The other thing, like,
I missed it with his 8 points being scored. I missed it after him scoring 8 points. I've been focusing on that.
The thing with the getting tangled with Bertuzzi before the Frederick goal, it's like, if anything, it would have been both. It's not like they just let both of them go. It's not like, you know, Marchand just did something really stupid and, oh my God, they didn't call it. They let him get away with it. It's like, no, they just let both of them keep going and let play continue.
Right. And people are saying they should have it. Like, some people were saying, sure, call them both, but blow it dead to call them both. Like, the fact that they kept the play going, it's like, guys, will you please? It's like, Charlie McAvoy takes a high stick from Tavares right in front of all of Air Canada Center. It's like, both teams are getting infractions not called on them. Like, relax. It's playoff hockey.
And it's like, you probably shouldn't be so distracted with what's going on at the blue line that you don't pay attention to Trent Frederick. It just seems
wouldn't have been a goal if Ilya Samsonov didn't just suck.
there was a stat out there that shot from that angle with that coverage goes in 3 out of 700 times.
Good job, Freddie. You beat the odds on that one.
Yeah.
I'd like to give Samsonov maybe the excuse that he was just busy watching Marchand and Bertuzzi and wondering the same thing about why isn't the whistle blowing? But you gotta play through it. So
the Bruins, real quick, the Bruins aren't the only ones that are learning from history from last year, because last year, after the Bruins went up 3-1, I may have screenshotted a picture of the three of us laughing on the episode, and I tweeted it from the Skate Pod account when the Bruins go up 3-1 in the series without Bergeron or Krejci, and we all know how that happened. So I'm not going to be overconfident here and tweet out anything from the Skate Pod account assuring a victory or laughing at anything, because until it's over, it's not over. But no, I'm learning my lesson too.
I think everybody learned that. It's not, none of it's a sure thing at all.
Speaking of Pastrnak, that goal last night, I know he scored a goal in game two, but does that goal last night give him some confidence going forward here now that he broke through? It was, again, another kind of a quiet game for him, buzzer to buzzer. And again, that goal, just a ridiculous overcommitment by Jake McCabe. A bad TJ Brody stuck in no man's land. Marchand does a lot of the work and Pastrnak finishes it. Still, though, does that help him, you think, going forward in this series? Could only help him, right?
Yeah, I think probably. And, you know, he continues to get his shot attempts. still would like to see him not have as many blocks as he has. But, you know, I know Montgomery talked up game three, said, you know, he could have had a hat trick in the first period. I don't know about that, but he definitely could have had at least one, maybe two. So he's getting looks, which I just feel like with a player like that, it's only a matter of time if he's getting them. He buries that easy one. He's been on the ice for a couple power play goals now. You know, they actually had, for Marchand's power play goal on Saturday, had Marchand, Pastrnak, and McAvoy all reunited. And asked Montgomery about that on Sunday, and he said, you know, basically it's kind of towards the end of the period and just the way the commercial breaks had gone, or I think it was close to a commercial break. It wasn't the end of the period. But he just thought it was a good opportunity to load up and get a little extra ice time in. So I don't know if they're going to do that more often, but even though he doesn't get a point, I think being out there for now, he's been on the ice for the last three power play goals. I think that helps too, because he wasn't on the ice for the first three in the series. So he's now seeing that, like, he's part of success. He's part of Bruins scoring, and feels like only a matter of time before he starts to get more points individually.
He made a Leafs fan cry in game four. That was the third goal of the game, 3-0, and with like 40 seconds left in the period. And they pan over to a Leafs fan with a towel just covering his face, like just looked like he was maybe shedding a tear under there. I mean, it was a huge turning point in that game. It was an emotional goal, in terms of feeling like, okay, this is 3-0. And we've been the better team, and Marner scores in the third, and there's a little bit of a pushback, a surge by Toronto, but that Pastrnak goal really was a confidence booster in that it felt like nobody's scoring more than three goals on Jeremy Swayman, right? It felt like it put the game out of reach. So I think that helps to the confidence boost of scoring that, because there was an emotion behind it.
Yeah, totally. And just that whole sequence of them going up 3-0 and then Toronto's booing the Maple Leafs off the ice. And then the Bruins skated off the ice for intermission so quickly with Marchand just telling everybody at the door, keep going, keep going, keep going. And it's just leading by example and then on the ice. And then just, you know, the leadership on display right now is insane from Marchand. Passes Kim Neely, most playoff goals in Bruins history. Just another notch in his Hall of Fame career, certainly an all-time Bruin. So, and you know, you have to appreciate it, right? Because we talked about it in the last week. Marchand had only 5 goals in his previous 35 games dating up until game 3, I think. So it's never guaranteed that stars come through. You're seeing it with Toronto's players. So when you see players play great in big moments, you have to appreciate it and not take it for granted.
There's one last thing I want to... Oh, sorry. You go ahead first, Scott, because I was going to change the subject, but...
I was going to say, it's funny how we're talking about Pastrnak having kind of a quiet series, and he still has 4 points in 4 games. No one on Toronto has 4 points. Like, you know, they're right. Probably like...
No one has points. More than one goal.
Jeez, like, we'd kill for someone to have 4 points in a series.
Right.
Yeah. What I was going to say is, this is one thought that's been kind of swirling around in my head during us talking about this and talking about the differences from last year to this year. Jim Montgomery feels like he's taken control more this season throughout the year and also in this series, where as last year, this might have just been throwing him under the bus. He was saying he was going off what goalie Bob was telling him to do in terms of goaltending. Now it feels like he's making those decisions, taking the lead on those decisions. He feels like he's, and this was something we talked about too, players kind of determining their own situations, players kind of being the voice, whereas this year you see Montgomery being more of the voice, and it's gone smoothly. And I'm thinking back on this series, and I'm thinking to myself, I can't recall a time where he made some sort of switch up, made some sort of decision that you could criticize, right? Like, if it was, it was very small. Like, there hasn't been a time where we're like, okay, that was on Montgomery.
Yeah, I think last year it was a combination of a couple of things. Number one, he was a rookie in a locker room full of, and when I say rookie, I mean to the Bruins organization. Yeah. He was a rookie in the locker room, which had Patrice Bergeron in there, who has been in that locker room since 2003, David Krejci 2006-07, Brad Marchand 2010, Nick Foligno, guys that's been around in the league for a decade plus, Taylor Hall, decade plus. I mean, the list goes on, right? There was a ton of leadership and command in that room from the player's perspective. I understand why Montgomery may have deferred to the players. It's natural. It's easy to sit here and say, you're the coach, own the room. Okay. But that room has been Patrice Bergeron's for 20 years, and it's easier said than done. So that's part of it, right? To your point, Bridget, it was the players kind of probably had a little bit more say with certain things, or Montgomery didn't want to rock the boat too much.
Yeah.
Especially when they had such a successful year. And also I think he was a little too, is it bright eyed and bushy tailed? Is that the phrase? Like, I remember last year after game six, like they lost, what was it, 7-6 or 6-5 or something. And Montgomery comes in. It was one of the worst defensive games the Bruins have played all year. They have another chance to win the series out the window. Now you got game seven at home. And Montgomery, after the game, is first thing he says is, what a great hockey game. Now, obviously he's trying to downplay the loss, but it's like,
it was 7-5.
That quote's going to get picked up. It's going to be turned into a story. And this year he's the opposite of that. He doesn't get too high or low in any situation. And when they do not perform, he's not afraid to talk about it in the media. And he just seems like a guy who had to kind of learn a lesson last year along with the rest of the team. And he's a great coach, but you have noticed a difference in him this year.
Yeah, to swing it all back around to my opening shift, like from Montgomery, those are lessons that he learned right, you know, going back to training camp this year that he learned from and started to implement. And one of them was exactly what you guys are saying. It was, he got more involved, more hands-on, louder voice, still trusting his leaders, but not always deferring, not blind trust. And part of that's been out of necessity too. Like, this team has needed more coaching than last year's did. You know, it's, when you're having a record-breaking regular season, it's hard to find spots to step in and assert yourself and say, you know, bring down the hammer and be like, we have to do this and this better, right? There were no bag skates in practice last year. Like, what, you know, the team goes on an 8-game winning streak and you lose one and you're going to bag skate them? Like, of course not. This year there's been opportunities to, like, there's, you know, and like the bag skates are just one example, but obviously they got attention when they happened. But all that kind of stuff, like, this team has needed a kick in the ass at times. They've needed more coaching. They started the season with two rookie centers in the lineup. You know, Mason Lorai has gone through his rookie season. Like, guys are stepping into bigger roles than they've ever had, whether that's a Zacha, Coyle, bigger role than he's ever had in Boston, at least. Frederick taking on more, you know, Morgan Geeky, the biggest role he's ever had. Like, all of this stuff requires coaching. And so he's, part of it is he's had to be more hands-on. And part of it is he said this, you know, in like his breakup press conference after last season, that he was probably too hands off. That was, you know, one of the many painful lessons learned from that playoff series last year.
Yeah. And my last point about Montgomery would be, this was a conversation, I feel like you and I, Scott, talked about this at one point, because I definitely heard it around talk radio. Well, what if the Bruins get bounced in round one again, which can still happen? Round one is not over. But I was hearing the conversation that if the Bruins get bounced in round one again, when it went, especially in this kind of situation where they're leading 3-1 in the series and somehow it all falls apart again, would Jim Montgomery be on the hot seat? Would he be potentially out of a job? But if the Bruins can close this out in five games or six games, or even if they can just close it out at all, you feel like that narrative goes away and we're not talking about that in the offseason. If he just gets past this first round, there's going to be more respect on the job that he's done through the 2 years that he's been here.
I mean, Jack Adams himself isn't keeping his job after back-to-back 3-1 series, you know, losses. That would be a tough look. And, you know, we talked about it a month ago or so. The precedent's been set, right? Claude Julien's first year in Boston, lost in the first round. Bruce Cassidy's first year in Boston, lost in the first round. They kept their jobs for quite some time because that following year, they made it out of the first round. So you have to see that progression of a coach when they have a team that's capable of performing to that standard. So, but hopefully we all like Jay Montgomery, and that, to your point, Bridget, that won't be a story, right? I mean, again, last year was tough. Like, you go up 3-1 in the series. What's he supposed to do? Tell Patrice Bergeron and David Krejci, Hall of Fame players, certainly Bergeron and Hall of Fame Bruin and Krejci, like, yeah, I'm sticking with Coyle and Zaka. Like, it's just, you can't do it. Anybody's saying, criticizing that, it's just disingenuous, because everybody would have done the same thing Jim Montgomery did. Patrice Bergeron, David Krejci tell you they want to play, you put them in the lineup. But this year, to your point, Bridget, there's not those temptations, there's not those issues as we currently speak. So everything is going well. Don't tinker with it. Try to close the series out in five.
Which, just to put a little bit of an asterisk on it, if they lose game seven, we will be having this conversation after the season is over, right? Like, this conversation only ends if the Bruins win one of the next three games.
Yeah, don't make us talk about it, right?
Right. Yeah. You can't collapse again like that. There's no universe where that's acceptable. And
no.
You know, on the, like, the Claude or Cassidy comparisons, it also, like, it does have to be noted, those guys inherited teams that were building up. Like, the reset, the bottom had already happened. Montgomery inherited a team, like, at the top. And now, like, this year is the one that should have been the reset. So, like, I would actually give him a little more leash. Like, if this was a really hard fought back and forth series that went seven and they lose game seven 3-2, great game, like, I would have a really hard time firing him. But now you're up 3-1. Like, yeah. To circle all this back to what we've been talking about, like, now you have to close it out. Like, that's it. It's required, you know. Yeah. Losing in seven is no longer a, well, hey, you know, it was a heck of a series. Like, no, you lose in seven now, you choked again.
Well, and you lost to the Panthers for a handful of reasons, but it's because they out-battled you the second half of that series. Like, is Mitch Marner going to start out-battling Brad Marchand? Like, I don't see it. It's just a different – now, I can sit here and say that. The Bruins can't say that. Like, but from a you know, spectator perspective, it's just really difficult to see the Bruins losing that battle of will against these players. So we'll see. We'll see. Tuesday night we'll be telling. So any closing final thoughts from the two of you?
That was all I got.
Mm.
Same.
Mm. Good job. Great job. All right, Bridget, now you can tell everybody what... No, I'm just kidding.
No.
All right. That'll do it for everybody. Have a great start to your work week, and we will talk to you on Wednesday.